interview conducted with John Burroughs and Hugh Craig at the University of Newcastle by Willard McCarty on behalf of Julian Nyan for the Oral History Project, Hidden Histories. I'm going to go through six questions which have been asked of everybody in this project, but unusually, because there are two of you and you've known each other for a long time, it's some sort of crosstalk between the two of you will make this particularly valuable record of your memories, recollections, and thoughts on very long careers in the digital humanities. The first question is, what are your earliest memories of encountering computing technology and what you thought of the computing technology you encountered at the time?
Yeah. In 1979, I had been code indexing examples of tolerably common words, frequent words, in Jane Austen's novels. My code indexing system was becoming intolerably overblown and complicated, difficult to manage. And I went downstairs to the director, the then director of our computing service, John Lambert, and asked him if any of this could be computerized. And he told me about COCO, and software program of the day for text management and preparation, and he responded with great interest and enthusiasm, and we went right on from there. So, the good fortune to have an early positive response from a highly competent and capable man.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Was it a Remington word processor that we had in the faculty? Which is my first contact with. There was a special room where the word processor was sitting. You remember, you were dean, and you put me in charge of that project, which was, and people were so, and yes, various. A couple of books were written on it, certainly. Now, when was that? That was in the maybe early 80s. So that was our first bit of word processing technology.
86, 87.
Okay, yeah.
It was known as the Dean's White Elephant.
Yes. You did have a few problems, yeah. Yes. The daisy wheels, I remember, they kept breaking.
I had an abominable machine. Problem. I was lucky enough to be away on sabbatical while it was being experienced and came back just after it was resolved. It had the wrong board fitted. A closely related but not identical model. And it took about 12 months and many visits from the technologists before it was discovered that all they had to do was insert the right board, after which it worked admirably, but by which time nobody was interested.
Yeah, people had spent too long.
And it cost $20,000 of faculty money, which at that time was a considerable sum.
Yes, yeah.
And okay, of course, it just predated the vigorous growth of PCs.
Yeah. It seemed like the solution at the time. Well, my...
So your experience was unluckier than mine. I wonder you kept going.
Well, that really was unrelated to computational stylistics, which I must have noted your work happening that here, particularly authorship attribution. And I was working on... a problem in Ben Jonson, the additions to the Spanish tragedy, and I thought, well, maybe we could apply this, maybe, you know, it'd be worthwhile applying to this computational stylistics. I don't think it was called then.
No.
And it wasn't called stylometrics either. What did you call it at the beginning?
Nothing.
Nothing. It just was...
Just what I was doing.
Yeah.
There are people, an American couple, the name I think was Sedler.
Yes, Sally and, I can't remember her husband's name, Sedlow.
They used the term in a little book of theirs, in the mid-70s, and I took it up from them,
yeah,
well, 20 years later, principally because I thought that by then we were outgrowing what had always been called stylometry, because we were doing more ambitious and complex things than just one-on-one contests between two candidate authors. We were doing more than authorship studies, and we were enlarging beyond one-on-one contests. In both those ways, I thought a new term was needed.
Yeah.
Now, the old term still survives, but the justification for the new one is
the old terms come back. You often you see it again.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure why. I think because new players keep coming in, and they just pick up on some of the older terminology, and it comes back.
Once again, this is the dearth of a history of the field,
yeah,
which we've talked about a number of times.
But I think it's what's always interested me is that the fact that you've got somebody in your own institution or even down the corridor doing something makes a big difference. And I think it's in terms of the sort of confidence you have that something can be seen through or that you'll get some payoff for your investment. I'm pretty sure if I'd been elsewhere and had just heard of John's work, I wouldn't have had the confidence to invest a lot of time. I would have thought, okay, I could spend a year doing this and get nothing out of it. I don't think I'll do that. But because something about, I had known John for a long time, but I think just there's something about proximity and the sense that you can observe almost on a daily basis that things are working out and things are progressing. So it's a bit hard to define, but that's why I got into it and persisted. And I know that was 1988 when I first did my first, I think I had half a dozen, maybe six Shakespeare plays and six Jonson plays that I used, in my first comparison. And the other thing I always say about that, I prepared Hamlet for that study in 1988, and I've probably used it at least every week since then, that same text over and over again. And that's the other great thing about these projects, is that it's a great advantage if it's not just a one-off, and they're almost not worth it for a one-off study, because you do such, to do it properly, there's such a big investment in the preparation of the text. I think that would be true even today, because nearly always you have to have, you might get a core database from somewhere, but nearly always you need to add something to that. So it really pays off when you keep reusing your material, and in my case, I've just been able to keep building it up to, I don't know, 225 plays or whatever since from those original ones. But the core ones are still being recycled pretty well. I won't say daily, but sort of weekly almost.
Mm.
Hamlet's still in there, and I prepared it in 1988.
Mm. Another piece of serendipity in my early days was my choice of an author. I'd been doing this stuff, as I said a while ago, with card indexes, looking at Jane Austen's language, and she just absorbed this sort of punishment. She always rewarded you with an interesting answer to your question. If I'd tackled some other stylistically duller author, I'd probably have given up long, long before. Well, she just kept seducing me. Which is not something Miss Austen might have wished to hear. And then, of course, shortly after my conversation with John Lambert in August, September 79, I went off to Cambridge for a year and had the good fortune to meet John Dawson. And through John and another man whose name escapes me at the moment, Robinson, I think, I was told about Susan Hockey and the work in the Oxford Centre. So between Dawson's centre in Cambridge and Susan Hockey's centre in Oxford, I was able to do a lot of crisscross travelling in the course of that year and learn a great deal and get a lot of encouragement and support in order to continue. So that was, I think I struck a lot of good luck early on in a number of ways when one might have been discouraged.
Yes, well, this interview interviews survivors, doesn't it? So. Stories of good luck are to be expected. The second question is, I'm not sure why it's here, really. It asks about training, formal, informal training. Both of you began when there was no formal training. I know I began when there was no formal training. And you've already more or less answered how you learned, but I'm wondering if you could comment a bit more on the process of picking this set of technologies up, and what that was like, your relationship to John Lambert, John in particular, because you had somebody in the computing center who was sympathetic.
That was enormously important. Lambert, in all of those years, he died in 2001. For the last 6 or 8 years of that time, through the later 90s, he had retired from his post as director of computing services, and to amuse himself and earn a bit of money on the side, he became our programmer in our centre and worked actively with us right up to the time of his death. And the prototype set of software that he designed for us, called LILAC, Literature and Language and Computing, the LILAC package I use every day still. It was never refined as he would have wished to see it, but he left us a good enough working model. Now, the essence of that part of it, I think, is how much the support the humanities person needs from the computing person, Lambert or Dawson or Hockey, while he's finding his feet. It was 15 years before I could do much work by myself, on my own, not referring to somebody else all the time. So the training was a long, long, slow process. Admittedly, in my own defence, I was a busy person at the time, doing a lot of other things.
Mm.
What about you?
Well, my comment is, it's just as well we weren't statisticians, and it's just as well we weren't linguists, because we would never have started. You know, the statisticians would have been worried about normal distribution of the data and, you know, worrying about not having enough and all that kind of stuff. I think we would have been too inhibited. And if we'd been linguists, we would have been interested in, you know, Chomsky and kind of universal grammar and not at all interested in data, as Chomsky wasn't. So we never got much buy-in from linguists. We got probably the best buy-in was from statisticians once we started to get, you know, accumulate quite a lot of data. But I think if we'd been trained, I don't know what you think about it, if you'd been a trained statistician or a trained linguist, I don't think one would have thought to do this kind of stuff, because it was very exploratory. And no one would have held that much hope of finding any interesting patterns.
I got
let's say the less training, the better.
Hmm. I got a great deal of support from our professor of statistics, Annette Dobson.
Yeah.
Sympathetic to my ignorance and stupidity. I had good help from statistically informed friends. But I agree with you here. On the whole, the more strongly expert people were statistically, the more inclined they were to want us to use methods that yielded definite answers, yes, no answers. And our interest was rather more in exploring to find out what the answers might be and what questions they might provoke. So the finality of linear discriminant analysis, for example, was never really suitable to our needs. It closed a question. We didn't want it closed. We wanted to go on thinking about why it should look like that.
Yeah, principal components analysis was just the key, wasn't it? It was
Absolutely.
Just a beautiful way of combining that multivariate, combining all those different variables in an exploratory way and letting the data speak for itself, which PCA does beautifully, as opposed to discriminant, which wants a closed answer and it overtrains and is over-optimistic and all those problems. I mean, that was really fortunate, and that was... Who put you on to PCA?
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Cambridge Computing Laboratory. Nick McLaren.
Yeah.
You know? And then friends at home refined the rough model that McLaren suggested and taught me how to use it better.
Function words, which nobody thought would give you anything, any joy whatsoever, because everyone used them about the same rate, and they were empty words or stop words, you know, classically.
That was me.
Yeah.
That was the one bit of all of this for which I claim personal credit. What I'd done with card indexing was teaching me that unexpectedly ordinary, boring, empty little words seemed to be doing a lot. And that's where the card indexing broke down, of course, because one can't index and of and z. And once I got into the computer setup, I was able to explore what did happen to and of and z. And much to my surprise and everybody else's, I think, the results were as interesting as the results from much more ostensibly interesting words of the kind that stylistics has always been interested in. So we got through to a layer that could not have seriously been penetrated without the computer.
Yeah, it was waiting for the computer to happen. Yeah, that part of language was waiting for the computer to arrive so that it could become visible. Yeah. And then PCA somehow went beautifully with function words. It was just that was John's winning hand. Function words plus PCA.
Yep. And I always expected to be completely overtaken and surpassed by some wealthy American institute, and it never actually happened. More like, I seem to be on a benevolent frame this afternoon.
We still come back to function words and PCA.
Yes.
You know, one goes down to the more interesting words, and lots of people find ways of doing that, and we have ourselves. But then you come back to function words, they're abundant. You know, you nearly always get, you know, they've got a good distribution. And they're extremely, you know, they're like the very fabric of language, aren't they?
They not only require the computer, they also require statistics.
Yeah.
Because you can't handle them by the one or by the ten.
People are always asking the question you've just answered, which is, where has the computer made a real difference that no one could have made by him or herself without it.
And yeah,
this is
John's
discovery. This is a very important point to.
You can imagine a Victorian parson mad enough to count up all the Z's or all the O's, but he could never have done multivariate things with them.
Mm.
And so that's the.
And he might have just
the first
done,
of those two steps is lunacy. to cut up the odds.
Yeah.
But the second of those two steps would have been impossible.
And he would have probably just done Shakespeare.
Yes.
And the other great thing, and he'd never been comparative.
Yes.
Which is the other great thing that's happened, is we've gone outside. And that's why I almost challenged John a little bit about Austen. I'm not sure, even if you'd started on Dickens, you might have got something of the same.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you're inside that author, you sort of feel that author is the world and.
Oh, it's not she alone,
but
it's a comparatively small number
of
authors with a really strong stylistic gift. I don't think it works for the common run of writers. Nothing in my work would support the idea that it works in the common
run. Down to the finest level of characters or progression of characters, yeah.
There's another important point there and that I picked up on as you were talking, and that is your relationship to the other disciplines that have touched your intellectual lives, a glancing or peripheral relationship, which had it been intimate would have paralyzed the work.
Yeah.
But starting from literature, you went out and picked up things here and there where they helped the work that would not have happened with any other kind of relationship with the
disciplines. Very dangerous. You're working on instinct rather than training, but you know, which is risky, certainly in statistics, but
it's a well-educated instinct.
Yeah.
I think we're fortunate in never really wanting to do anything other than study literature.
Yeah.
And that, you know, all of the other things were ancillary to that central purpose, literary questions, questions of a literary scholar. Now, they might have been the questions of a linguistic scholar or an historian or whatever. For us, they were, have been, and continue to be the questions of literary people.
We probably should break and go and have a cup of tea.
And we can return to this?
Yeah,
I hope. Okay. Right, now we're resuming the interview with the question of influence. In your career, You've spoken of one or two strong influences, but who else, perhaps including those at a distance, people whose books you read?
On the whole, not in computing. You know, sort of, as I said, I picked that up en passant.
Yeah.
As time went along, I guess the background influences, let me think. I was enormously impressed by Wolfgang Clement and Shakespeare's imagery for the way it took up detail of the figures and showed how they worked through the plays dramatically. And in a way, I think what I'm doing is something like what Clement did, except that I'm doing it with words rather than with images. And I might say, by the way, looking back to an earlier answer, both Hugh and I laid some emphasis on the function words, and a lot of the work we did early on especially, and still to a very large extent, is about them. But increasingly the other words have come into play as we've got a better understanding of what we're doing. Our vocabulary is spread from the bottom up rather than the top down, so to speak. So we are enriching as we proceed, so we like to think.
Mm.
So Clement's one. I was also enormously impressed by Ernst Robert Curtius's European literature in the Latin Middle Ages because of the way in which it was written. Interned in Istanbul, I think it was, during the war, quite without a library, and simply having to write out of his head about what he thought of some of the books that had meant most to him. A remarkable study. Those two. And then afterwards, yes, the new critics generally.
Richards and Ogden, for example?
Not so much the English one as the Americans.
No.
I didn't ever warm to Richards. I didn't quite find his wavelength, or he didn't quite find mine. I could see his importance, but he didn't really speak to me.
Hmm.
But some of the Americans did. And I suppose the Fields of Light guy, too, was terribly important to me. I've lost his name for the moment. That'll come back to me after he's had a turn.
Yeah, it's... I don't know that there's anyone very close to what we do that's been a big influence. I mean, I suppose I lived through deconstruction and postmodernism and those sort of eras, but that was so, in many ways, probably defined myself against some of that work. Very fascinated by it, definitely embedded in my thinking, but a lot of what I've been doing is trying to push back against some of those sort of that sort of work. Very influenced, I suppose, by new historicism in our own area, in the Renaissance area, people like Stephen Greenblatt there. So-called cultural poetics, a good sort of overview, a good broadening from close reading. I don't know. A lot of that doesn't relate all that directly to what we actually do. We had a really nice visit from George Hunter, G.K. Hunter, who did a literary history of Renaissance, English, Renaissance English, and that kind of. So always looking for people who have a broader sort of conspectus view, because that's I think what the computational stuff does well. It's extensive rather than intensive, which people, I think, have struggled with because we're so used to the intensive. But the real gain, I think, is from the wide sweep. So one looks for people there. Robert Weimann, German scholar, latterly does that kind of thing. Has some really sort of broad perspectives. But often we're looking for myths to bust. So almost you read these. Read people to find a reasonably sort of categorical statement, preferably slightly quantitative, which can then be tested. So that's a strange form of influence. It's like, give me something I can disprove. So I suppose I have a vaguely oppositional kind of perspective on the on what would otherwise be influences or whatever.
Mm.
The name I lost was Reuben Arthur Brower, Fields of Light.
Fields of Light?
Mm. Brower, Robert Penmoran was another of the new critics who spoke to me very strongly.
What about other people who were using computers in their research when you got started? Were there any? Did you draw anything from them? Do you remember what their views of what you were doing or of computing generally were?
I didn't have a lot of close contact, partly because there wasn't much else going on in Australia at that time, and I just had the brief relevant periods in Cambridge. So on the whole, no. I did learn a lot in the later time, in the 80s and 90s, late 80s and 1990s, at conferences from people like Susan Hocking, Paul Fortier. Heard some splendid papers here and there at the conferences. But on the whole, not much in the way of close contact, because there was never anyone much close to me until you came along, and that made things more interesting as we began talking together and working together.
How about the people here in the computing center? You mentioned Lambert. What did you think about the computing center and the relation of a person like you to people in it?
Well, it was only one-on-one, Lambert and me.
Yeah.
I'd go down to talk to him. His deputy, Paul Butler, was helpful at times. But on the whole, I didn't have much connection with the centre as a centre, or service, it was rather, computing service, much more with the director.
Right.
So it's a personal affair rather than a departmental one.
Yeah. How about you, Hugh?
Which part of it? The
relation to other people using computing at the time, and your feeling closeness to them or distance from them. I mean, I know that in my case, I actively disliked most of the people having something to do with computing for many years.
Yes, not a club you wanted to.
Not a club
to,
I wanted
to
join.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't have any strong feelings. I guess the centre was already sort of providing that sort of ambience, so and technical support. So it was already well entrained. Didn't have to do much pioneering there. Certainly no negative experiences. It was fairly restricted, really. There weren't a lot of competitors or not a lot of opposition. So
The journals were important, literary and linguistic computing particularly. Computing in the humanities as well. It's the only field in which I've ever worked where people really seem to read each other's articles. In English studies, I think on the whole, this wouldn't be altogether true, a lot of people write for the standard academic necessity of writing, but don't on the whole interchange ideas with each other. And they don't much care about what the other guy is writing. And that's putting it too strongly, but I feel there's a step difference between the interrelationships in English studies and those in the general area of digital humanities, where people really do seem to know what other people have said in the journals.
I've heard this said before, too, with respect to the friendliness of the community and the degree to which people want to relate to each other. I know that was my experience.
And not too much belligerence either, of the kind you so commonly get, for example, in classics. where so many of them hate each other. Across the scholarly world, I don't mean locally.
Yeah.
Whereas these people, well, there have been some notable attacks, generally on deserving objects. But
yeah.
I don't think that there's much general belligerence at all.
The interesting relationship, I reckon, is with our English colleagues.
Yes.
In the English department or discipline or whatever. I mean, that's been the most potent one for me, like trying to persuade them that this is a worthwhile activity and that you're actually learning something this way. And I don't know if they ever got quite persuaded, but keeping on trying.
Their skepticism is enormously useful.
Yeah, that's right. So we had a number of very, very bright, learned sort of colleagues who we found hard to persuade, but kept trying, and that's a very good sort of proving ground.
Yes.
And I think in the end, probably some of them are halfway there. They're halfway there to the point that they can see that there is some value in it, but they wouldn't want to do it themselves. And I guess it's slightly disappointing. It would have nicely go over the other, you know, get a few more over the line, in which they said, yeah, I can see this valuable, and I'm prepared to spend the next 6 months doing it. Mm. But yeah, I certainly learned a lot about trying to persuade close colleagues that I really respected that this was something worthwhile, and still get the reaction. It's an awful lot of trouble to learn so little. Then you have to persuade them. Well, it's little, but at least it's something you know. If you know what I mean. Whereas you can make a grand statement, as they like to, on the whole.
Well, it's a little bit at a time.
A little bit of time, and what there is solid. You know what I mean? It's not likely to be reversed in a hurry. But otherwise, as I say, I'm just looking for claims that we can reverse or support.
I think your father, Rachel, mentioned it.
Yeah.
As a shrewd questioner and a
challenger. Yeah, very shrewd questioner. Oh, and a great question. You remember that question from Anne Barton in Cambridge?
Oh, yes.
This is in the very early days when I was trying to persuade Anne Barton, who's a very good Ben Johnson scholar, of a certain thing. She said, yeah, this sounds fine, but I just don't know how much faith to have in your results. Which was a brilliant, you know, like, okay, I can see technically it might be okay, but how much faith do I have in my mind? Should it really change my mind when, as a reader, I might think something differently? That's always so we've all sort of lived by that, you know.
Stayed with us both.
And my father is a good mathematician, and so I work with him actually doing some PCAs. I don't think I could do them now, but doing the diagonalizing the matrix and so on. That was good in the early days for trying to make sure we really understood what was happening.
Mm. John, you used a phrase that I like about mounting evidence that these multitude of weak markers add up to something secure, that they add up to a view of literature which is probabilistic, and that the ground is, well, my words, the ground is getting more and more solid, but it's the mounting evidence that struck me, the patience over time of advancing, and I think it is advancing step by step, that was brought to mind by your comment about the little thing you have versus the grand statement. The last of the required questions required of me, is about conferences. You've mentioned a bit about conferences. I suppose that the size of this country and its distance from where most of the conference activity in English literature goes on meant that there weren't a lot of them. But when did the conference engagement with this kind of work begin? And what was it like?
Well, I gave a paper to a conference in Adelaide, the Australian branch of the MLA, Paula, in 74, and just talked about some word counts in Jane Austen, and someone said, have you tested this at all with anything like the chi-squared test? And I said, I don't know anything about that. I just count on my fingers. A simple word count. And here are the comparative results. And there you are. Well, it wasn't until afterwards in Cambridge that I began to understand about chi-squared and a few other things 5-6 years later. Overseas conferences for me in this field, I mean.
Yeah.
I began in San Francisco in what must have been 81. The big ICH ALLC conference of that year. And from then on I went to it, around every second year for a dozen years or so.
Mm.
And then after I retired, I slowly eased out of it. I found it well worth doing, thoroughly enjoyed the people and the papers, very arduous. I was head of department a lot of that time and a dean, and so I'd come back to a desk full of work, but it was worth it.
Mm.
I'd be away only a week, and Australia to America or Europe and back in a week, and a desk full of work when you get back. Pretty solid but it was worth it. I suppose any particularly memorable one. Yeah, Columbia, South Carolina. You were there, weren't it, at the time?
Yes, I was.
That was a good one. Georgetown, in about 93. You and Harold were both there. Harold and I had a great dinner together and nearly got drowned by passing a car in a rainstorm.
Christchurch in 91.
Oh, it's Christchurch 91.
That's when I met you.
That's a good one, too. Yes, that's right. We were both together at Columbia, but we didn't meet.
Mm.
We met in 91 in Christchurch, that's right. Yes, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And reading Hilary Mantel lately and learning a little more about the history of that college adds to the richness to those memories.
Yes.
New York 2001 was memorable for lots of the rest of us, John.
Mm. Yes. Well, in Christchurch in 91, it was the first time I'd ever heard John talk.
Yeah.
And I went up to him afterwards. I went up to him afterwards and I effused in my typical fashion. And we've been friends ever since.
That's a good beginning.
Found not. What's on you?
The only thing that comes to mind is I think what we both have always tried to do is persuade our colleagues in our discipline. And so conferences in Renaissance literature or Shakespeare or whatever have been just as important.
Mm.
And almost that's where I feel the work really has to be done. I mean, it's very good to learn about what other people are doing technically and so on in the DH type conferences. But, I mean, one of the things that I think makes us distinctive is this, and we made a resolution at some point that we would always try to get articles in good journals in our discipline, and that those are the people we really wanted to persuade. And it's still the quest, but I think that's been distinctive in that we've always tried to keep that link with the discipline and keep persuading our colleagues, perhaps to no avail, but
we've had a victory or two.
Yeah,
but not a huge number.
No,
the mainstream
no,
journals are still very hard to persuade.
Yeah, but increasingly they are more.
Yeah,
they are more open. Yeah, definitely.
It's
the best
beginning to be said in America that digital humanities is the next big thing. It'd be nice if that were true.
Yeah, it's the last big thing.
Section purposely silenced to resume shortly.
That was it was in Debrecen.
Yeah, Debrecen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first Busa lecture.
Yes.
Delivered by Father Busa himself.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I was at the Zampoli Center at the time. So flew with him and from Pisa to Hungary. That was a good conference.
I suppose I should mention the Pisa conference. In New York,
that's why I mentioned it.
It's an oversight.
That's why I mentioned it, John.
It's a prompt.
Oh, sorry, I didn't catch it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's a memorable event personally. A very happy conference it was too.
Mm-hmm.
Just before 9/11,
that's
3 months before.
That's right.
We were told that the city was safe to walk about, and it was.
Mm.
The last question is my own, and it's off-piste. If you look back on what you've done and what has happened in the field since you got started, what do you think is really important that has happened in these years, and can you use that to pick out a trajectory for the field, or more than one trajectory for the field, into the future? Not to predict the future, but to say what are the possibilities that are now before us?
So what are the big developments?
What about the past
really
comes out to you as important that you did and you saw being done in the area in which you worked? And how could, using that, what do you see for the future?
Okay, you said it was your question.
That's typical.
Yeah.
I want you to answer too.
Oh, I'm not dodgy. I'm letting you go first. Is the future.
So is it what oneself has done, or you mean what?
Yes, I mean start
done?
There.
Yeah.
Start there with what you've done that you think is actually important for the future of the field. Something you're proud of, something you're ashamed of. But really that kind of autobiographical sorting of the past to try to pull from it something that we've learned.
Yeah.
That makes our choices in the future more like another step in the trajectory.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm responding to that question.
I'll think up another question.
Okay.
I'll try now. What do you think? I think that it's all empirical at present, and to my mind that is generally speaking a very good thing. We've learned a great deal about the details, the ways in which language works, close in text, as Hugh was saying a while ago. It's become increasingly possible to reach out to larger and larger corpora as the capacity of computers improves and their speed, so that we're able to do more with less, and we know much more than we did about the intricacies of stylistic patterns. It's nevertheless true that, as Agamemnon said, I don't agree with his derogatory way of saying it. He says the field is a mess. There have been some notable achievements, major achievements. Now, the field is a mess, he thinks, because no one has a deep understanding of why the patterns work and what they really mean. Now, what that deep understanding might be, I don't really begin to understand. So for me, that's a very good question for the future, and I'd like to meet the person who's going to offer answers that speak to me. I don't know what form they'd take. For me, there's never been any surprise in the idea that authors should be identifiable by their style. identify patterns in their language any more than if you and Hugh, if you three people, come along the corridor towards me. I don't have to stop and think. Is that woman? Is that you? Is that Harold? It's there. Everything about you speaks to me. The way you move, the way you dress, the way you speak, everything you do, the way you eat. We're like that. We have so much in common, we humans, but we're different suddenly in so many ways. And it's not in the least degree remarkable to me that people seem surprised and surprised and surprised that our individuality should speak through and beyond and out of our community. That's the sort of a deep understanding that I would understand. But I don't think that's what argument means. And I would like to know what this other deep understanding of what it's all about might look like.
I think that's
an answer.
That's exactly what I think, almost. Yeah. The sort of epiphany, I remember when you said something about, it must be all the way through when you were working on that article. This is, that there are different individuality, your individuation is there in all the different strata, and you said something about, not surprising people dress differently and all the rest of it. And I think that crystallized that whole issue of language individuation, which sort of is the answer to the idea that the author is dead and all the rest of it. And it's the empirical answer that, yes, people in fact do make their own language and dialect out of languages. And that sort of gave the underpinning for a whole lot of work, not only authorship, but individuation in general. And but I think we've sort of worked through that. It's almost so obvious once you do it, that I think that battle is almost like won.
Except that people don't believe it.
No, but I mean, I'm satisfied, you know what I mean? I think everyone sensible is satisfied. You know, it just makes obvious true. And I don't, so I think that's a real contribution that computational stylistics has made, to have that broader idea and then work it through in a whole mass of different studies which show that authors can be distinguished, and then move on to a more theoretical. Linguists are still not very interested in the individuation of language. That's not what they do. They like much more general things about languages or even about sociolects or whatever. Still not very interested in individuation. But I don't know, I feel we've probably done that work. And there's I don't know what the next phase is beyond that. And some people still feel that the work of computational stylistics is to endlessly prove that authors are different, and that computational stylistics can show that. I think we're sort of bored with that. We don't want to keep demonstrating that. It has been demonstrated. It's as rock solid as anything can be. It's no longer the mission of computational stylistics, and it would be good maybe if it was disassociated from it.
Hang on, no.
Because we've got our answer.
No, there's a double spin here. On the one hand, what you say in principle is absolutely true. On the other hand, for me at least, the particular problems of authorship remain fascinating.
Yes.
Because there are so many of them unresolved.
Yes.
Now,
true.
So I no longer feel that there's any need to demonstrate that it can be demonstrated.
Yeah.
But I still passionately believe that the real interest and the real challenge lies in the particular problems themselves. However, it's not just authorship attribution. Individuation is larger and more interesting than that. And while my own work will probably continue to be mostly in authorship attribution, I think the larger issues are fascinating, and maybe there's room for a lot more work there.
There is always a to and fro between attribution, which is kind of the bread and butter, and continues to sort of ground or authenticate or validate the work of computational stylistics. And then there's always the temptation or the interest in something beyond authorship. So I guess one continues to go back and forth between those two. And the great thing, authorship is a very good testing ground because people are really interested in the answer.
Mm.
And you can't muck about and you can't sort of do too much hand-waving and about very general concepts. Okay, what's the answer kind of thing? And it's the area where people will actually check your sums and go back and people like Mac Jackson will go back and sort of actually check your figures. And I think that's quite unusual, certainly in our area. You know, most people will accept that table of numbers. But so that's the good thing about authorship. It gets people's interest to a very profound degree. But it's not the whole of the possibilities of the field.
What strikes me, and this is maybe it doesn't make any sense, I don't know, in one of his books, Ian Hacking remarks that the great achievement of 20th century physics is the realization that nature is probabilistic.
Mm.
The fact that you two have shown that literary language is probabilistic means that we as authors are operating in the natural world as the natural world operates.
Mm.
And that's more of a question than an answer.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really interesting question.
A very elegant way of saying that I was fumbling with that about the character of individuality.
The fact that we are such an intimate part of the natural world and have been pretending to be separate from it for a very long time. We are an intimate part of it down to the most elusive of artistic aspects of artistic expression, style. As you say, it's instantly recognizable when you're walking down the hall. I'm not to pause to know who it is.
Yeah, style is the other key. Yeah. It was one of the keys, definitely, that concept.
How far can we take this? How far can we take that probabilistic bond that we have with the natural world? Sociologists have been puzzling over this in large crowds of people and such for a long time. But there's a continuum here that seems to me to be a really interesting question. That's what I say is the significance of your work, you know, when I'm asked or when I can say it.
Think of those people with good musical memories who can recognize something in a phrase, a couple of bars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it's like.
What?
Their memory is setting that little bit into their full, rich, remembered sense of what all the other things are like. And it fits in just there. That's style. But you do it in tennis, you do it in cricket.
Mm-hmm.
It's a circumambient.
Mm-hmm.
We're part of the natural world.
One of the things that I think of as your most significant achievement, actually you touched on early in the interview, and that is that the purpose is questions, not answers. Even within the context that in an authorship study, you are trying to establish an answer.
Yeah.
The method and the results are actually about the questions.
Yeah.
And that in a world that often gets far too fixated on the quantitative as being a way to answer questions.
Yeah.
Keeps this work rooted in the humanities, which I think has just been incredibly valuable for the field and continues to be.
Authorship, again, there's an idea of ears that's always meant a lot to me since you first put it to me 15 years ago. When you make a proper attribution of a poem, you're fitting it into an interpretative nexus where it makes more sense than when you try to force it into some alien nexus. And that's get it into its proper home, and then you see that the shape of the home has changed a little bit.
Mm.
And so you go on again. So it's not just, yes, this poem is Rochester's, it's what that means to Rochester.
It's some, well, there's some connection there with computing power and speed, which is that an older method, you had to construct a sort of test and a hypothesis, and then you could painfully run that through, get an answer one way or the other, then maybe try again. But that was a very sort of rigid structure. But power of the computational power means you can do that exploratory data analysis, which change a parameter, redo it, and then it becomes open.
Yes.
In the way you're describing. And I think that's what people perhaps don't realise. I mean, they still have a model where you run it through and
oh,
the answer comes out.
Yes.
But that's really not what it's like. And people say, can your program tell you, could your program tell you who wrote this? Well, that shows no understanding whatsoever of the processes involved in doing a complicated authorship problem.
Aaron Love used to say that after you finish the computation and the calculations and all the rest of it, that's when the brain work begins.
Yeah. But then you can redo them all.
Hmm.
Which
one did happen at one of our symposia? He was very distressed by the way you were talking right now. He said, you know, having you called an experiment when you change your mind a dozen times in the course of a morning, you come at it from so many different angles in different ways.
Yeah.
That's not an experiment.
Oh, we know now from really good work in the history of science, like David Gooding's on experiment, that's exactly how experiments work.
Yeah.
And that's one of the second thing that I think is really important about this work, is that it exemplifies the experimental method, which is brand new to the humanities.
Yeah. Mm.
The idea of that iterative trial, that proposing to oneself of what Gooding calls construals, which are part coming from you, part coming from the experimental apparatus, the text, and this formation of construals that then prove to be not so robust and to disappear and reforming in them.
Yeah.
And when I started, you took your, you planned your computer program out really, really well, did a flow chart and all that. And then you key punched, and you took your deck of cards down to the computer center. And if you were really, really, really important, like you're a Nobel Prize physicist, you could get your answers back in a couple of hours. Otherwise, it was 2 days or a week.
Yeah.
Only to learn that you've made some key punch error.
Yeah.
And so it was only the hackers at MIT who talked about the hands-on imperative who understood. They were sitting at the console at midnight to 8 in the morning playing with a computer. They understood this experimental, which now we have because we have these small machines.
Yeah.
But you're pointing to that, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. That's experiment, the idea of experiment.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about Catherine Bode's paper at last year's AADA conference was in her opening, she rejected the Moretti model of distant reading in favor of your experimental model, as she called it.
Mm.
And she said it just, and then the rest of her paper was about her own experiments, and she and it was saying exactly what you were saying. That
Jason Ensor, who knows her, who's in WA and doesn't have an academic job, I think, alas.
That's right.
Jason said distant reading is just close reading paying attention to something else. Something like that, anyway. In that book of essays that Catherine Bode
edited
with somebody else, that's where Jason's, it's a really good article. Something about 10,416 Australian novels.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it's a critique of the whole idea of distant reading, which Mark Olson proposed 10 years before Moretti came out with the term.
Yeah.
In a paper to the MLA that shocked the pants off of everyone. Well, thank you too for very much for the interview. It will eventually be transcribed and edited probably by me. I think that's probably going to happen. and it will appear online and in print in some fashion or other.
Well, you'll be set for review first.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. We'll get a chance to have a look.
It'll be sent to you for review first.
Yeah.